Good evening and welcome to tonight's Yale Club of Silicon Valley and Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program brought to you from Silicon Valley Bank. My name is Pulin Sangvi and I'm with the Yale Club of Silicon Valley. It is my pleasure to introduce Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Chris began his career at the American Prospect, where he still maintains a position as a senior correspondent and contributes regularly to publications like the Washington Post, Boston Globe, and the LA Times. A contributing editor for Science Progress, Chris's popular blog, The Intersection, won the 2005 Scientific American Science and Technology Web Award and is currently featured on DiscoverMagazine.com. His first book, The Republican War on Science, was a New York Times bestseller, and his 2005 feature story for Mother Jones on ExxonMobil, conservative think tanks, and climate change was nominated for a National Magazine Award in the public interest category. A graduate of Yale University, Chris is currently a visiting associate at Princeton University's Center for Collaborative History. This fall, he will also begin a prestigious Knight Science Journalism Fellowship at MIT. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Chris Mooney.
Thank you. It's great to be here. You heard in the introduction that I'm probably best known for a book that you've probably come across before. It was entitled The Republican War on Science, and we've got some of them here. And at the outset of talks, I definitely like to disclose to my audiences that there was no conscious intention, I don't know if you can see, to create a visual pun here, which turns upon my last name and the image of the elephant. So, you know, we only really became aware of that later. The new book, Unscientific America, is really the sequel 4 years later to the first one, and it's written for the Obama years in much the way that the Republican War was written for the Bush years, and I guess that's something that you can also see from the covers, because we've gone from a situation in 2005 where a big stupid elephant had trampled on the test tube, and so here it is, and the elephant's immobile, to a situation in 2009 where, guess what, the test tube is still broken, the iconic test tube of science, but the cause for it being broken is ambiguous and not so obvious, and I think that's sort of the nature of the transition between the two. So I want to tell you a little bit more at the outset of how I got from one to the other. The Republican War book argued that under the last administration, under Bush, scientific knowledge itself was under attack in the government on key policy issues like climate change and the science of climate change, stem cell research, endangered species protections, reproductive health science, and many, many others. And the book was pretty popular, so inevitably I was pulled out to lecture about it. I'd never even been on a book tour before. I'd never really given many public talks. In my early presentations on the subject, my strategy as a communicator was to sort of bowl the audiences over with a long litany of all of the abuses, all of the ways in which science had been undermined by the last administration. And this had a predictable and recurrent effect on the audiences. The audiences would get outraged. There would be a lot of frustration. These were science-friendly people. That's why they'd come out to hear me. And then at the end, the hands would go up, and I would get the same question over and over. Members of the audience, many of them scientists or people who cared, would say something like, okay, you've made me angry. You've made me want to punch a wall. I can't believe this kind of stuff is going on in my government. What you haven't done is you haven't given me any release. You haven't told me what I can do about this problem. And I realized my instinctual answer to this question, which was, buy the book, was not sufficient. So I started trying to think about new answers, thinking about new solutions to what was essentially a broad disconnect between science, politics, and our society. And I asked myself questions like these. How did the Bush administration get away with it? Was it something about American culture that made that possible? Was it something about the media that made that possible, and was a new way of thinking about science communication part of the answer? In other words, you could say I was starting to examine a set of underlying problems of science in America that would certainly remain with us long after Bush's party was thrown out of the White House. And around the same time, I also teamed up with a young marine biologist named Cheryl Kirschenbaum, who is my co-blogger and has been since 2007. And she is, her name is not smaller because she's less important, but because she has more letters. So that's, bear that in mind. And she really, she made me aware of something that I, as a journalist, definitely was not tuned into, which is what it's like to be a young scientist at a university today. And there's a lot of that in the book. And also aware of the growing number of young researchers like herself who have taken or are in the process of contemplating taking an increasingly common career departure, which is, they're scientists, but they're not sure they're going to go on to be, try to be tenured professors and do research all their lives. They want to take that science that they've learned and they want to go somewhere else with it. I meet these people on every campus that I go to. And I'd work with Cheryl on an initiative, which we devote a whole chapter to in the book, because I think it is that important. And the initiative was something called Science Debate 2008. And that's where we got together with a small group of like-minded people to just pursue an idea. The idea being that given that science is so important to policy in the future, anyone who wants to be president ought to be willing to discuss science policy. Not the facts of science, not naming subatomic particles, but the relevance of science. So having a position on global warming and being able to articulate why. And we really managed to rally a lot of the American scientific community behind this simple goal. There should be a debate. Science matters. There should be a debate. And we felt really good about ourselves. Here's our 100 university presidents. Here's our dozens of Nobel laureates. Here's our 38,000 individual, signatories. It was a movement, and it still is. Hopefully, it will still be in 2012. But then we learned something, which is that, just because you build it doesn't mean that they will come. The politicians were not so keen on this idea of discussing science on the campaign trail. And that further got us thinking about, again, this problem. Why do we have such a huge disconnect between science and society in the United States? So Unscientific America was the result of this process. It was our attempt to understand the problem, not of, how to do research, because I think we have that figured out in a significant extent, but rather why science doesn't get through to the people who often need it most. Well, to tackle this, let's start with some of the basic data. I think all of you have probably heard some of this before, but I'll just go over it. Americans don't know a ton about science. I think there is a basic illiteracy problem that, only half of Americans can correctly state that the Earth goes around the sun. It takes a year to do it. And if you try to get them to explain why the seasons change, you can just forget about it. It's not going to happen. You ask Americans what's smaller, an electron or an atom, again, you only get about half right. You ask them about evolution, you get these terrible figures where, nearly half rejected, and even, many of those are young Earth creationists think the Earth is less than 10,000 years old, and on and on and on. You go to a policy-relevant topic like climate change, and 84% of scientists think it's real and human-caused, and just 49% of Americans do. That's the gap. We argue, though, that we know these figures. We know they're not good. And they reflect definitely poorly on the educational system. But it's not just knowledge of the facts that matters. And I certainly wouldn't want anyone to think that that's what our book argues, because it's just as significant, I believe, that scientists in America today aren't really seen as role models. They're not looked up to by kids. 44% of Americans cannot even name a scientific role model. And among those few who do, guess who the top answers are? They are Bill Gates, Al Gore, and Albert Einstein. And what this group has in common is these are people who are either not scientists or not alive. That's science in American culture today, and it's not good. And it's not that Americans hate science. They don't. They have vague, positive feelings of trust toward scientists, and also the sense that science makes our lives better. So that's, it could be worse. they could hate it. But rather, they have vague, positive feelings attached to not really much knowledge at all. The problem, then, is not their negativity as much as the fact that it's not on their radar, it's not central to their lives, and that's just a bad situation to be in when you consider how much science is going to shape policy and how much science is going to shape the future, and that's what worries us. So another way of saying this is that the problem we're trying to address is the one of translating science into different spheres of American life. And such translation is a critical issue today, not only because of a new generation of science policies science policy controversies that we're going to see once we're finally done fighting over stem cells, and if we're ever done fighting over global warming, we will then have a new generation of science policy fights, I can assure you. So it's relevant for that reason, but also because we live in a time of media upheaval, when science journalists are vanishing from the traditional press, and it's not at all clear who is going to be there, if anyone, to take their place. The reality is that the translators of science may have to be, to a large extent, the scientists themselves, simply because there might not be anyone else who has a job to do it. And that's a key thing. That leads to a key thing that's different about the book. This is not a screed about how dumb Americans are. We don't just point the finger when it comes to these problems of translating scientific knowledge. We don't say people in politics are just cynical. We don't say average Americans are just stupid. And we don't say people who are religious are just brainwashed. Instead, in honor of C.P. Snow, the British novelist and scientist, we adopt two cultures analysis. And we say, you know, there is clearly a divide between the scientists and not so much the literary people, that's what Snow was worried about 50 years ago in Britain, but the scientists and let's say everybody else. But if there's a divide, you know, there's two ways you could approach it. You could say, all right, there's a divide, I'm over here, those people are over there, those people need to come closer to me. Or you could say, there's a divide, those people are over there, I'm over here, how can I get closer to those people? And we think, obviously, both sides should move. But since we're the ones looking at the divide and lamenting it, that makes it incumbent upon us to think about what we can do about it. It's not just a gap between scientists and the public. That's sort of the big overarching gap. But we try to break it down in the book, and we talk about four smaller gaps, or rather four more specific gaps, where science clearly doesn't get through to people who really matter, who have influence, where it should get through. And those are the gaps between science and politics, the gap between science and the news media, the gap between science and the entertainment industry or the entertainment media, and then finally the gap between science and the religious community. And I'll just give you a brief sense of how we tackle these, although, of course, we're pretty much more extensive than this in the book. Science and politics looks at it looks at many things, the cynical misuse of scientific information by politicians, and also how scientists don't know how to present scientific information in a way that's useful to politicians. And it keys off of the Science Debate 2008 experience, where we quickly learned that although scientists and politicians have a very different worldview, scientists think, what could be better than to have a public debate where science policy is discussed on the campaign trail, because then we will have a more informed electorate, and we will have a better election, and science will be, you know, in its rightful place. And politicians think, oh, my God, I'm going to have a Dan Quayle moment. I'm going to flub something about science, and the media is going to talk about it for a week, and I'm going to mispronounce something, whatever it is, and I'm not going to get elected. That's one of the gaps. And frankly, there just aren't many people in politics, and this should change, who know much about the scientific community. I just moved. But I've lived for 6 months in Princeton, New Jersey, and there we are actually are represented by a physicist, Rush Holt, and so you can see the car in front of you has a bumper sticker saying, my congressman is a rocket scientist. But this is not the norm. One thing we can do to bridge this divide, and we talk about this more in the book, is to actually elect politicians who are either scientists or know something about it. There hasn't really been much of an attempt to do this, although it's hard to know why not. It'd be great to have scientists nearly so well represented in Congress as lawyers, but we should also train scientists themselves so that they're more adept at making what they know relevant and useful to politicians. Because politicians, they have to use science to be politicians. They can't just take it in the abstract and know what to do with it. They don't have time, and they rarely have the staffs for it. So we go into that divide in some detail. The next, then, is the gap between scientists and the modern media. And this is another two cultures divide, if ever there was one. Journalists and scientists, although supposedly united by the search for truth, really go about pursuing that search for truth in very different ways. And in the book, we get into some of the different worldviews that inform the two professions. But perhaps even more important than that basic divide is what's happening now in the media today, which exacerbates it. And that is the fact that science journalists are vanishing from the traditional press. And they're vanishing for broad economic and technological reasons. The newspaper industry is in dire straits because of the internet, because of the loss of advertising. And it turns out that science journalism is among the first things to go. It goes before the sports section. You know, it goes before the horoscope. And what is the result of this? And, of course, it's also the case in other parts of the mass media that science is not treated in much detail. Something like, this is a Pew figure, if you watch 5 hours of cable news or 300 minutes, you can expect to see about 1 minute devoted to science and technology. That's the average. Even as newspapers cut their science sections, and they've been cutting them regularly, CNN got rid of its science and technology unit late last year. This is the way things are going. And so we have a real problem in terms of expecting that there are going to be people there to convey science to the broad public. Rather, what you get, if anything, is you get the mass migration of all the information about science to the web. And we argue in the book that that's definitely not any salvation. Now, the thing about science on the web is that there's lots of great stuff, there's lots of terrible stuff, and there's no reason to think that one is going to triumph over the other. Rather, what's going to happen, what does happen, what you see happen, is that the people who already like science are empowered, and they know where to go to get good stuff. And those are the people that already like science, so we're back in our little world again. Everybody else, they go to the place where there's bad science, so they go to the anti-vaccination people on the web, or the anti-evolution people on the web, or the anti-global warming people on the web, all of whom are very popular, at least as popular as the good science people, or else, more likely, they don't go to anything science-related at all. And that's most of America. So that's not, you know, there are many good things about blogging about science on the internet, but you cannot say that it is unifying our culture around some shared body of information about science, which is what I believe that we need. Then there's science in the entertainment industry. And here, you know, this is sort of one of the most fun chapters. We talk about, we talk about inaccuracy in movies. And there's, you know, plenty of that, and one shouldn't get too exercised about it because this is, after all, fiction. But we like to have a little bit of fun with some of the films. Has anybody seen The Core in this room, 2003? It's like the worst sci-fi movie ever. You know, and in that one, they the planet's core stops rotating, the Earth is attacked by deadly microwaves from space, and the microwaves destroy the Golden Gate Bridge. So this one is relevant to you. And, microwaves couldn't do that. And if the core stopped rotating, we would have much bigger problems. But the great thing about the movie is that they go to the center of the Earth, and they're going to start the core again with nukes, of course. And to get to the center of the Earth, they use a material called unobtainium. So, you know, there's many examples like that in the book. So we have a little bit of fun with it. But really, you know, getting things wrong in a fictional narrative is not the end of the world. Explosions in space in Star Wars aren't the end of the world. What is significant, though, is you live in a society where only 18% of the public knows a scientist personally. We know that. And so that means that for the rest, they're going to have to be going on some kind of stereotype. Where is the stereotype coming from? It's coming from entertainment media. Everyone in my generation, they might not know a scientist, but they definitely know Doc from Back to the Future, right? They know the guy with the lights flashing on his head. And it turns out that there are some cliched depictions of scientists that have recurred for a long time. Scientists tend to be either the nerd, socially dysfunctional, weird, Doc, or the bad guy, the villain. And you can see these stereotypes. Kids are aware of them. So we talk about studies in the book where, you know, you talk to young children and you have scientists visit their classrooms. And then the kids think it's a hoax. They think it's not a scientist because it isn't an old, angry man. So this stuff, you know, obviously this stuff has a big effect on our culture. So we talk about that divide and what scientists might be able to do to make it a little better. And to some extent, I think Hollywood is changing, and there's a lot of science content now that cuts a bit more against the grain. So that's a positive thing. And then the last divide is sort of the nastiest, the most polarizing, the one that we fight over endlessly, on and on and on. It's science and religion, right? And this one just doesn't go away. And of course, it is the case that religion is one of the key blocks in terms of keeping people from accepting science in the United States, particularly on something like evolution. The creationists argue scientifically, partly because they have to for legal reasons. But if you actually figure out the people who are the followers, that's not really what animates them. What animates them is the sense that science is an assault on their values, particularly evolutionary science. In other words, they're being told from many, many pulpits over and over again that Darwin is the source of sin. It's the loss of morality. It means a lack of meaning for you and your children. And that's an incredibly powerful and incredibly scary thing. So religion pushes a lot of America away from science. But then on top of that, we have a culture war because we lob our missiles from the other side of the divide at religion from the world of science. And this is sort of what the New Atheism movement does that we criticize in the book, is thinking that religion is... that if somehow we attack religion, we're going to get people to deconvert and to come back to science. And in fact, that's not the case at all. If you attack religion from the world of science, then you're just reinforcing what they're already hearing from their pulpits in the first place. So rather, what we need to do is we need to find ways to actually let the people in the middle ground, the people who are combining religion and science in some way in their lives, and there are certainly many of them, to be the go-betweens that help us, eat away at, it's going to be very hard, eat away at the fundamentalist base that continues to deny evolution. So those are sort of the big divides that we try to bridge in the book. And, the book is definitely generating some controversy now, particularly online, and it's kind of creating a bifurcated reaction. There's people in science who read it and they say, thank God, finally, we know that we haven't been doing this communication thing. We know it's important. And to them, it's obvious. And not only is it obvious, but it's something they've been waiting for. And then there's people in science who say, how dare you blame the scientists? And so we're getting both reactions. But I think that this idea of needing to build bridges to the other parts of America where science isn't getting through, where it needs to get through better, is catching on in science today, although there's certainly resistance to it. But if it's catching on, if it's resonating, it's for the following reason. Think about where we find ourselves. Basically, for 50 years in the U.S., we trace some of the history in the book, but basically post-Sputnik, magnificent research has been done. There have been incredible innovations that we're all proud of, reaching the moon, decoding the genome, the internet, much, much else. But what are we not so proud of? Well, over those years, much of the public clearly didn't come along on the incredible odyssey of discovery. And the scientists didn't learn nearly as much about reaching the public as they learned about understanding nature, because that wasn't where they were focused. And so insofar as the book is resonating, it's because maybe that's an imbalance that it's finally time to redress. And that, if anything, is the takeaway point from the book. And I'll just end by describing a couple of things that we propose as solutions. But I think the solutions are open-ended. We've got to try a lot of things. The point is we've got to align ourselves so that we can think about solutions that do involve the scientific world. Obviously, science education is in a poor state. Obviously, we've got to improve that. Obviously, journalism and the collapse of science in the media is a massive problem. And fixes for that are, it's hard to know what to do when you're standing up against gigantic economic and technological forces. But these are clearly things that are keeping people away from science. But what about the scientists themselves? And what about, more particularly, the way that they are trained? And I want to end on this note. We've long heard concerns, I think they're valid, that there are reasons to worry about the United States' competitiveness in science going forward. It's basically a rearview mirror kind of argument. We're ahead, but look at the car behind us. It's China. It's coming up fast. It's India. It's coming up fast. And there are many reasons to think that that is something that could be a real threat to the United States economy down the road, if it's not already. But less heard, and so then this leads to the argument we need to produce more scientists. We need to produce more scientists. What you don't hear is that at home, we're also not creating enough opportunities for our scientific talent. So here's a figure that's left out of the discussion too much. Only 7% of PhDs age 35 and under these days get tenure-track faculty jobs. The rest, not only do they often want, but they need to do something else, given the odds in academia. So our argument is, well, you got all these people trained in science, knowing about science, and that means they come to this problem with a crucial leg up. The leg up is that they know what everybody else is missing, Right? They actually do have science on the radar. All right? They are on the science side of the divide, and they often want to do something to bring science across a divide. So our argument is, couldn't we, if we were creative and we had some money, couldn't we kill two birds with one stone? Couldn't we create new valves in the academic pipeline for some of these young scientists, because the pipeline's all blocked up, and let them use their own ingenuity with some opportunity, with a fellowship, with a nonprofit job position, to become experts, to specialize in reaching out to politicians, to the media, to the entertainment world, to the religious community especially. Can we create jobs to do this? Because I know that there are people who would stampede towards filling those positions. And that's part of the solution that we propose. And it's a bit blue sky in the sense that there, you know, you need funding for it. But that funding is going to have to come partly from the government. It's going to come partly from philanthropy. And partly it's going to have to reflect a realignment of university priorities. And at the same time, universities for these young scientists, so many of whom are not going to become, not going to become their mentors, their professors. Universities, it's incumbent upon them to train them in other skills in communication, because that's what they're going to have to go on to do. So that's starting to address the solution. And what would the world look like if everything that we call for is realized? I will leave you with a quotation from a good friend of mine and the guy who founded, originally came up with the idea for the Science Debate 2008 initiative. His name is Matthew Chapman. He happens to be the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin. He is a screenwriter in New York City. He's worked on such films as Runaway Jury. And he put it like this. Instead of being derided as geeks or nerds, scientists should be seen as courageous realists and the last great heroic explorers of the unknown. They should get more money, more publicity, better clothes, more sex, and free rehab when the fame goes to their heads. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. So how does it go now? Kevin, do I introduce you? Do you introduce yourself?
They told me I introduced myself.
Okay.
You just heard, I'm Kevin Padian. I am fortunate enough to have been asked to convey your questions to Chris Mooney tonight. We are, as you know, on the Commonwealth Club, co-sponsored by the Yale Club, both of Silicon Valley. And it's a great pleasure to be here to talk with Chris Mooney about his new book with Cheryl Kirshenbaum called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And after these brief remarks, Chris, the first question that seems to occur is, why is Stephen Colbert a better spokesman for science than the president of NASA or any other scientific organization?
Oh, gosh. Well, that's a real easy one. No, it is. I mean, I would argue that some of the most important science communication today that does occurs on the Colbert Report. And why is that? Well, first, it's short, it's entertaining. It's for the people who do not have the time to really dig in, or the interest to really dig in. But they're still getting something serious. They're still getting something substantive. It is, you know, in a humorous way, really quite serious. And it's reaching, an audience that, I forget, I've looked up the audience before, but it's always over 1 million people. So when you're reaching a mass audience that big, you definitely cannot give them a scientific paper, and you can't even give them a Scientific American article. So science has to be communicated differently based on the audience. And there's going to be audiences for whom it has to be partly entertaining. And yeah.
Do you notice anything particular when Colbert has a scientist on his show? Mm-hmm. Do you notice anything about the way he talks with them that makes them easier to swallow, basically, than it might be if they present?
Yeah, he knocks
paper.
Them off their rhythm. I mean, he doesn't let them. You know, for example, if they were, and mostly the scientists that he has on were not the kind of scientists who would do this. Like, he has Neil deGrasse Tyson on a lot, okay, and he knows plenty about the media, I can assure you, and about being on television. So this is not a problem. But Colbert would never let the scientist sort of give a snooze speech about. You know, you would get a crazy off the wall question really quick. I've been on Colbert. I was only on for a short snippet of something like 4 minutes, and I was sitting at the table with him. I was sitting actually where he starts the show, not over at the author table. But it was a great experience, and the best part of it was I was talking about the importance of basic research, You know, how we've got to do the basic work because, you know, you never know what technologies are going to come out of it. And he said, are you saying there are stem cells in my iPhone? So, which is great science communication in a much more succinct way than I had done it. And it makes the same point, right? So anyway.
In your book, you have a good deal to say about Randy Olson's, who was a biologist turned filmmaker, his film Flock of Dodos, which is about the creation evolution controversy in America. Who are the dodos in that film, and why does this film resonate with you?
As I read that film, and everyone should see it, Flock of Dodos, I'm sure you know you can just Google it. And Olson has a book coming out, I'll add, that's called Don't Be Such a Scientist, which is coming after ours, which I have it. I've looked at it. He doesn't want me to talk about its content yet, but I think it does resonate because it's another book that's focused on science communication. And so is the film. The film is the story of intelligent design, the battle over it, and it's called Flock of Dodos. And as it turns out, everybody is a dodo, right? The intelligent design people are dodos because they're wrong about the science. The scientists are dodos because they don't know how to explain the science, and they don't know how to counter the intelligent design movement, which is very slick and well-funded and cares not about science but about communication and can't really be answered strictly in a scientific manner. And so that's sort of the upshot of the film. And it's great, and it's very entertaining. And there's this one scene that really resonated for me and continues to, where there's a group of scientists sitting around a poker table. And they're having a drink, and you know he's just filming them. I guess they're playing poker. You don't really see them play poker. You just see them talk, and they're evolutionary scientists, or at least they're scientists that are engaged in the evolution debate, and they're talking about dealing with those intelligent design people. And one of the scientists says, "I think people have to stand up and say, you're an idiot," right? Which is, I mean, I understand the sentiment, right? I've been there, but that's not what's going to work. So,
yeah. You suggest in your book that we should think about a scientifically literate America. What would that look like?
Well, what it wouldn't look like necessarily. I mean, we can idealize, and it would be nice if everybody knew a great deal of science. You know, a nation of PhDs is beyond conception, right? But people could certainly know more factually, and that would be a good thing. But I don't think that's the crucial thing. I think the crucial thing is that people definitely get a good science education in high school and in college. If they go, then they should get a good science education. But what's most centrally important is that they know some of the science basics, sort of the greatest hits of the different fields, so evolution, plate tectonics, Big Bang, that kind of stuff. But even more than that, that they are engaged with the science issues of their time. In other words, they're focused on science as it actually matters to their lives and to the society they belong to. So that means if there's a local fight about science, you know, over evolution, that they're keyed into that, they see why it matters, and they have something like the tools to assess. Or if there's a national fight, like global warming, again, they're able to participate as citizens in these key science issues. So, you know, I think it's my view of it, it's not just a literacy test, it's also, you know, strongly a citizenship test. How much can you participate, given that so much of policy is going to depend on science? You're really kind of disenfranchised if you don't know not only how much of your tax money is going to science, but how science is feeding in to big decisions.
Yeah, science education mm-hmm. in our school system apparently is struggling to mm-hmm. properly prepare students. If you could help suggest several reforms or initiatives, what would maybe attract the greatest reform? What's the most possible reform we could do?
So not being a science education expert, let me give a direction rather than a policy, because I feel like if I gave something explicit, it would be do this to no Child Left Behind, and I probably wouldn't know enough, you know, sort of statute-wise. But I think that what I hear from people who are education experts is that something happens where, you know, young kids, science is cool to them, they are engaged, and they like space, and they like dinosaurs and that kind of stuff. And you start to lose them somewhere around middle school, where a lot of other things are going on. And so, first of all, they're harder to keep attuned. But also, this is widespread perception, and I think valid, that a lot of science becomes just rote learning, memorization. And this is math, too. You know, you memorize stuff, the periodic table of the elements. And science isn't presented in a context where it's relevant to your life. It's a chore. And the smart kids just beat the system. They memorize. They're really good at memorizing. And, you know, other kids just say, what does this have for me? This is just busy work. So what we've got to do is we got to find ways at that time to, and, you know, and obviously some teachers do this. Good teachers do this. Good schools do this. But make it relevant. Make it relevant at that time when you might be losing them. How do you do that? It takes teaching creativity. But I'll give one example that I think would work. And I know there are courses that do this at the college level. And done well, I think that this would do a lot. The physics of film. I would show kids Hollywood films, preferably ones that are recent, preferably ones that are popular. And then I would take, you know, sci-fi genre. And I would do like we did with the core, you know. I would take it apart. I would say, can this happen? What can you learn about earth science from the core? I mean, you know, these are the kinds of things where they're like, oh, like I saw in the movie, but not. You know? So I think that kind of teaching, it's not a policy reform, but it's a direction of what you want.
It's an attitude a sense of a way of getting at that, isn't it? How do you feel about, in many curricula, since the Sputnik revolution, where U.S. Got caught flat-footed, we really made an attempt to really super educate our kids in science so that in seventh grade you were learning about Krebs cycles and plasmids and all sorts, but not about why the sky is blue or how the tides work and how the sorts of things you're talking about. Mm-hmm. To what extent do we have to trade off just general literacy about things like that with a kind of a pre-college science in order to make these sorts of inroads in overall literacy?
I think to a significant extent you can't have both, but I wonder how much it's a trade, because what I said before I think is true. It certainly describes my experience of science in high school, is that people are memorizing, you know, they're memorizing this pre-college stuff, and they're not retaining it. You know, I didn't retain any of it. I didn't learn, and this is not fair to my teachers. I said this at Politics and Prose in D.C., and the sister of my math teacher in high school was there and is going to report back to her. But I really memorized math, you know, and I didn't learn math until a lot later, and then I didn't learn it well. But I didn't have a conceptual way of thinking about what it was that I was doing, but I could do it. And so I'm not sure that we're actually even, achieving as much as we think.
And you did not become a scientist because...
I didn't become a scientist. I think partly I was turned off by that. But I came from a family of writers and literary people, and then that was just the pedigree, and that was what I was always going to do. And science came back on my radar when great science popularizers like Richard Dawkins and Stephen Jay Gould... their books I came across, and they were the people who made it matter to me, you know, in the great popular science book era of the 1990s. So they caught me, and I'm sure they caught a lot of other people. Not quite reaching as many people as Sagan, but definitely important.
So. And be honest with us, how many times did you flunk organic chemistry?
No, I never took organic chemistry, but it sounded like murder. You know, I knew people who took it at Yale, and they were always talking about how bad it was. Yeah. I took physics for poets.
Which is much better.
Which was totally a cop out, and that was as a freshman. And later, by the time I was a junior, I realized that I really wanted to study science, and by then I had to be an English major. But then I started taking a lot of stuff.
And it's hard to get into the interesting science classes without going through all those jumpers. I mean, I had a friend at Yale who was a TA in the organic chemistry course. Even he couldn't help me through it. So it was... I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, and it's important to, I mean, so those classes, I mean, those are kind of like the weeding people out classes. Those are the classes that are meant to kill some students. And the idea is if you die, you shouldn't be there, right? You know, you're not going to go to medical school or you're not going to be a scientist. So that's only the right kind of course for a certain kind of people who are going to med school or who are going to be a scientist. I mean, for everybody else, including someone like me, I don't think I was ever going to be a real scientist. Rather, I was going to be someone who cared about science in different contexts than actual research. I mean, I think the best bridge by far at the college level is the history of science. Because, you know, the history of science, you've got just amazing stories, you know, that everyone can relate to. And there's all these, I mean, I did this at Princeton last semester, so I'm pretty fired up about it. But it makes it much, much more accessible. The problem is historians of science have their all sort of wonk thing, you know, their particular way of, they say the word epistemology way too much. Okay, but you know, nevertheless, there's a lot there that can be drawn upon,
mm-hmm. and they situate it in cultural and social context, makes so much sense in terms of putting a human face on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I mean, I think that you know, Darwin's life was boring after the Beagle, but I mean, some of these people had pretty interesting lives, so you can get a lot out of the human interest angle.
You talked a bit in your book about Carl Sagan and how he paid for his efforts to popularize science in terms of his reception among his colleagues. And certainly being a paleontologist, I saw that happen to Steve Gould quite a bit. Do you think things are getting better, first of all? And you know, who would you say is your personal mm-hmm. hero in all of this? It doesn't have to be a scientist, but someone who's trying to advance this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is somewhat anecdotal, but I believe it. I don't think many people, and so when I say this, I sound optimistic, and then scientists come up to me and they're like, "You have no idea, nothing's changed." but I think that people are a little embarrassed today about the National Academy of Sciences not letting Sagan in. I think it's kind of a skeleton in the closet. Does that mean that I think there is a lingering anti-popularization sentiment? Definitely. But I think things are changing. I really do think they're changing. I think that the young people in science today don't feel that way at all. And I guess maybe that's who I talk to. So who's a hero? I mean, I think there's a lot of heroes out there. I mean, for me, the heroes are not famous. They are people like the scientists in the American Association for the Advancement. I mean, I don't want to put anybody else down. There's a lot of people who are doing good things. But people who are doing great things for what we care about in this book are people like the scientists who go into the American Association for the Advancement of Science Congressional Fellowship Program. And these are people who take their scientific knowledge and they go and work on Capitol Hill in congressional offices, or they go and work in the administration. And they bring this great set of scientific skills from a PhD, usually level education, into a political problem-solving context, where they learn to be these wonderful crossover experts. That's the kind of program that we desperately need, not only for the science world to have more of an impact, but the political world desperately needs it. And there's still way too few people in congressional offices that have this kind of knowledge.
That's a wonderful way to think about it, too. It coupled with that, wouldn't it be great if their universities, the great research universities, Berkeley, Stanford, Harvard, mm-hmm. also rewarded that kind of experience, also put public service as important as research and teaching, if they could actually do it. But how much money do you bring into the university from doing that kind of public service?
Exactly. That's the trick. And so, it has to be... it has to be also funding agencies, I think, and their prioritization. We talk about it as a cultural change. And again, I think it's happening. And I want to emphasize, this is not to the detriment of research, okay? I mean, we always are going to need great scientists. The numbers suggest that we have more than enough people going into science to create them. And I think that there's going to be self-selection because there's so much competition. The people who are really going to be the great scientists, I think, are going to be the great scientists. I think we have them. The question is what we do with everybody else. And I think that I see some schools. You know, it's anecdotal. I haven't done the study, but you know, I see programs, and I'm going to teach in one actually a week from today at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, a course taught by Jeremy Jackson, who's a marine biologist, and it's funded by the National Science Foundation's IGERT program, which is integrative research, and I forget exactly what it stands for, but it's interdisciplinary, right? And they're bringing in me and Cheryl for a 2-day. They do many, many guest teachers, but we're doing the 2-day intensive boot camp on science in the media and what it is like to communicate through this nasty, unpredictable beast that is the press. And, you know, the first day is the old media, the second day is the new media. So
this is increasingly cropping up in scientific society meetings as well, isn't it? Are you a part to any of that? Or are you seeing that?
Well, in terms of scientific society meetings, I guess, again, anecdotally, you know, the American Geophysical Union a couple of years back devoted a big session to communication. The American Meteorological Society, who I've had more direct involvement with, is definitely very, very, very high in this. American Institute of Biological Sciences is very into this. So I think that the National Academy of Sciences is quite interested in this. I think things are changing. I think some people in science welcome it. I think some people in science don't have time for it, and some actively really kind of don't like it. But,
and increasingly, grants to agencies like the National Science Foundation ask you quite specifically, what are you going to do for the public? How is this going to benefit the public? What public outreach activities are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
That's a real sea change from some years ago, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think it's important. But from what I hear, there was a policy piece, policy forum in Science about this by a scientist from Woods Hole, who I forget, who's very much in tune with the kind of arguments I'm making, another marine scientist who said that so far those things tend to be often done sort of as the work you don't want to do. You know, you really want the research grant. And this is something, you know, where you're dotting your I's and crossing your T's, and you're like, I put up a website. I don't know if anybody went to the website, but I put up a website. So I mean, I don't know. I know that the grants contain this component. I don't know to what extent it is being. I don't know if they looked at it. To what extent is it being filled out, and how is it being? How is it being done?
Yeah. A question in your previous book, when you were doing your research on the Bush era, did you find a connection between people who spoke out against the government dismissal of scientific fact and the fear of losing their government funding research?
Yeah. It's tricky because mostly the what I called the war on science did not show up. The central areas in which it showed up did not involve research grants. The central areas in which it showed up involved government reports on controversial topics that were put out by agencies like the Council on Environmental Quality, the Climate Change Science Program. In other words, it more involved government researchers who were employees rather than university researchers who were trying to get grants. But I'm sure that there's some sense in which what I called the war on science definitely affected grants. So, I mean, I know there have been members of Congress, and who it is I'm forgetting. The names right now who will go through the research grants and, you know, look at anything related to sex
or evolution
and sort of make problems. So that stuff is not immune from politics, but the Bush administration, what it was doing, didn't seem to be mainly felt in terms of research funding.
Did you have any evidence that that during that era there was a greater level of appointment to administrative jobs of people who were more sort of party line than qualified and also difficult to get out of the system? Because you hear this sometimes. Mm-hmm. I wondered whether your research had showed that that actually, whereas you can replace the head of an agency, having a lot of career people in the upper echelons of administration are not easy to get out.
Yeah, and in fact, no, that is definitely right. And I think that in the introduction, when I wrote a new introduction to Republican War on Science, a new preface, I think I actually talk about this, and I'll read it to you. But I wrote this in 2006. But that said, you know, the Bush administration science agencies collectively overflow with hundreds more political appointees than roamed the government at the end of the Clinton years. According to Princeton University political scientist David E. Lewis, the spike upward under Bush has been on the order of about 350 appointees. So in other words, political appointees, and that's a particular category of government employee, and it puts them in a position where usually they are the boss of scientists at these agencies. There were more of them in the Bush administration. And I think that that is directly responsible, just that dynamic where you got a political person over you and you're a career government scientist. That dynamic is basically what generated most of the scandals, because the scientist is just going about doing what they've done under other administrations, and suddenly, you know, the boss is much more controlling. And the boss is controlling about the content of the information, and suddenly, whistleblower, 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 you know, like, they're messing with my science. I think that's, you know, kind of the, really the administrative story of what happened in the last administration.
And how do you think the Obama administration will be different, if it will be?
Well, I think that they've already deliberately set out to be different. So, you know, there was an executive order that, you know, was promulgated, I forget when, and signed, that was explicitly designed at adopting government-wide policies to be administered by the Office of Science and Technology Policy that were going to look at all these kinds of problems and address them. And so the question is, what have they done? I don't know. I haven't looked at that, but it's only been about 5 months, and, you know, So a process has started. Also, basically the political dynamics are different. I'm sure a lot of people are still in the agencies that want to fight over this stuff. But the administration also changed its position on a lot of the most contentious science things. So the inherent dynamic between a political person and a scientist, right or wrong, I mean, it's not the same. So I think that will also diffuse tensions. I know that they're probably going to be science issues in the administration. It's hard to think there wouldn't be when you have that big a government. But.
And so you also mentioned before something that we're all unfortunately very familiar with, the decline of science reporting in newspapers and on television and other media. Some major newspapers have dropped their science coverage, or they've dropped most of their science writers. It's a much thinner section, if it appears at all. We think about how much the blogosphere has taken over from the science journalism osphere and the investigative reporter osphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can bloggers really replace? I mean, you're a blogger. What's your experience with this? What do you think this is going to do to everything we're doing?
I think that it is not the replacement. It is a completely different thing, and its drawbacks are at least as good as its benefits. Blogs don't have the problem of substance. Twitter has a problem of substance, right? You can't say anything. But that's not what it's for. Blogs, you definitely can go on and you can put out a lot of science. You can put out, you can put figures, you know, you can put data, you can link to tons of good stuff. That's not the problem. The problem is really audience. And also more recently, the problem is tone. We could get into that, but the problem is audience. The problem is who's reading this stuff, because it's written by scientists or people who care about science for people like them, and you know that's really not America. And I think that I only see that the internet and the fragmentation of media and the atomization of us leading in one direction, and that is to have the science world off in one place and everybody else doing all these other things. So you have to actively counter that. And you have to use, I mean, the way it is now, you've got to use new media tools to counter that, because that's really all the tools people have nowadays. So what are those tools? I mean, I'm not saying give up on blogs, but I am saying that if you want to use blogs, it would probably be wise to try to go to, you know, use blogs that are not just the science-only blogs. And then the question is, how on earth do you get into the other ones? Why are they going to, you know, not open the door when a science blogger comes knocking? It's a good question. Already, the political blogs and the science blogs are very different and don't really read each other that much. But there are many other new media tools that are some ways you can do more with. And what we really need are, you know, again, this army of of talented young science people who are going to be new media savvy and who are going to find these ways. Because I can only do so much. I'm not technologically able to make the viral YouTube vid that's going to save science. You know.
Are in this mix, are books on science relevant anymore? Can they be expected to find an audience?
Well, I hope, you know, I mean, so it's very hard. I mean, I know from the inside, I don't have data on it, but much like what's happening in newspapers, the publishing industry is definitely struggling right now. The book publishing industry is struggling. And a lot of the trends are the same, related, and, you know, things with celebrity-oriented books still do very well. You know, the sort of substantive nonfiction, like that kind of stuff. I mean, it's tough in the book industry, and they are hurting like a lot of people in the media are. Can science books have an impact? Oh, yeah. I mean, because the impact of a book can be very significant, even if it only sells like 50,000 copies. I mean, the Republican War on Science is—I don't know, look at the last number, but it was something like 50,000. But that was that had a very significant political impact, because people, when they do get a book and they do read it, they engage in a very deep way. You know, more than even sitting through a movie. It's rare that you get that much of anybody's time ever. So,
and your books don't have any pictures in them. I almost thought you were European.
No.
You know, because Americans aren't used to reading books on science without having pictures and drawings every couple of pages.
I'm a words guy, and it really is holding me back.
But you seem to get the point across without pictures, graphs, and charts.
I try. I have PowerPoints that actually have some data in them. Not for you today.
A lot of people know that you know, given either that science is not so well taught in our schools, or we don't retain it, or both, and this somehow accounts for our standing in all these studies that compare Americans with people from other countries in their scientific literacy, it almost seems like a lot of this science instruction is of necessity moving to television journalism. I mean, what people didn't even learn about the basics in science is part and parcel of these media, including blogs with all links to things like that. Do journalists and TV documentary makers, do they want to educate people on science? Is that what their goal is?
I think that's the goal of some of them. I don't think that is dominant, the desire to educate. It's going to be more common in a, you know, an NPR, PBS context, in a nonprofit media context. And mostly, these are money-making companies. And that dominates. And you know, they're publicly traded money-making companies. They've got to keep eyeballs fixed. And educating cannot be the most important goal. Now, I would argue that you can educate in an entertaining way, and you really just need the creative people to do it. But I mean, they're not listening to me.
Is it important that a documentary maker, for example, for an hour special on Discovery Channel or whatever, are they supposed to give people a background in science, or is it supposed to be, you know, more sort of he said, she said, or here's what looks sexy, or new, or here's a bunch of explosions? Should this pass for science infotainment?
Yeah, you got to judge them. I mean, you got to judge the products differently. Discovery is a very interesting case because you definitely got some shows that educate, and you've got some shows that are about like an apparent haunted house or something like that. So, I mean, that shows you, right, that to some extent, science is being made entertaining, and there's education going on. You know, in Mythbusters, I think people would say that is very educational while also being entertaining. But in some cases, it's just entertainment. The thing about, you know, Discovery Channel is very important to discuss because it's one of the most prominent science media outlets, not the most prominent, seen by people. And that's significant. But again, it's a very small, I mean, in terms of what everybody's paying attention to, there's so much other stuff out there that it still ends up being, I think, fairly selective. Although the biggest, you know, for TV in many ways.
Well, in our field, we discuss this a lot because when there's a series on television like Jurassic Fight Club, in which the premise appears to be, could this dinosaur beat up this other dinosaur? And we have scientists arguing about not whether Tyrannosaurus could beat up Carcharodontosaurus, but whether this is how we want to present science and whether we as scientists should involve ourselves with that. And some people say, no, because you're just encouraging them. And other people say, yes, but if we don't do it, they'll have some other idiots on who will give them even worse information than we'll give them. Yeah. So the last question then is, Chris, could Tyrannosaurus beat up Carcharodontosaurus?
I think you know the answer to that one. And I think you should participate.
Very well said. We've been talking with Chris Mooney, who has been the author of The Republican War on Science, and his new book with Cheryl Kirshenbaum is Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Can we give Chris a warm welcome? Applause. Thank you.
I hope you all enjoyed tonight's presentation by the Yale Club of Silicon Valley and the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we would like to thank Chris Mooney, author of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future, for a very, very thought-provoking presentation. And we'd also like to thank Kevin Padian, professor of integrative biology and curator of paleontology at UC Berkeley. And all of you for joining us. And now this meeting is adjourned.